My next guest blurs the line between artist and activist. Aboriginal artist Richard Bell's documentary You Can Go Now is screening at the Maoriland Film Festival, which is underway in Otaki. In it, he poses provocative and humorous challenges to the status quo and to our preconceived ideas of Aboriginal art. And Richard's with us now. Kia ora, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Kia ora.
Good to have you with us this morning. Ah, we can hear you. Yep, we can hear you for sure. It's lovely to have you with us today. I really enjoyed watching the film. I'm interested to know how it came about, because I know that you've got a long history, which is partly chronicled in the film. But how did you get to the point of actually making this movie?
Well, I have aspirations to make films. The opportunity came up to make this documentary, and I agreed to let them make this thing about me. But in exchange, I wanted to get an executive producer credit. So I got quid pro quo.
What were you wanting? Hello? What were you wanting to do?
I wanted an executive producer credit out of it, and a director's credit, and a writer's credit for my film collaborator. Yeah, they showed a part of our film. I made a film about the destruction of my home, the bulldozing of my home when I was 14.
It's very political. It's a polemic. I think one of your collaborator says that you were born politicized. Is that a fair view?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff being said about me, you know, so some of them I agree with and some I disagree with.
It also talks about you being an activist masquerading as an artist, and I'm interested in the line, or if there's a line between those two things for you.
No, there isn't really. What I'm doing is basically activism. I'm making work about the situation that Aboriginal people find ourselves in, you know, in this neo-colonial world. There's a lot of material out there. You know, that's why I've been able to do it for more than 30 years.
The opening of...
Without repeating myself too often?
The opening of the film is great because you're on the water going to the Venice Biennale with an artwork. Yes. Tell us a little bit about that and how you ended up there.
Oh, well, I put in a proposal to represent Australia at the Venice Biennale. And my proposal was to wrap the Australian Pavilion in chains, you know, and lock everybody out, you know, for the entire 6 months of the exhibition, and have discussions about that giant sculpture, you know, like off-site, you know, at an Aboriginal tent embassy. And unfortunately, that for me, they knocked that back. You know, like, but I wasn't put off, so I thought, oh well, okay, what's the next best thing I can do? So I figured that if I built a model of the Australian Pavilion in Venice and wrap that in some chains and put it on a barge and sail it up and down past the Biennale in opening week and have discussions about that sculpture in an Aboriginal tent embassy. So that's what I did.
And the Aboriginal tent embassy, there's a lot about that in the film, because... That yes. Harks back to a pretty important time in Australian politics and activism.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the coming together of people from all over Australia, like, for a protest for the first time, and that happened in Canberra, the national capital, in 1972, January 1972. Four young men were sent down to Canberra to set up an Aboriginal tent embassy, and the thinking there was that we needed an embassy because, you know, like, we were treated as foreigners in our own country. And that protest was, really notable because apparently it was reported, in 86 different countries around the world, which was quite phenomenal. Our story hadn't reached anywhere near that many nations, previously, so it was really critical to our progress.
Yeah, how was it received by the politicians?
Well, they were quite nonplussed because they couldn't remove them. Because if you had less than 11 tents on that site, they could do nothing about it. But if there were 12, they could have torn them all down. So they had to introduce new legislation that made it illegal to camp there.
That element of humor, that element of sort of playfulness, comes into your art pretty extensively. Why do you find that that is such a useful weapon?
Oh, it's the best weapon. To take people, to and from the comfort zone. Into and out of the comfort zone. Get them there. Take them on a bit of a ride. Drop them down in the depths. We would tell them, how bad they are. And what, and then we're lighten the load for them, and bring them back up, and so they're willing to listen to us again. Otherwise, they just if they stop listening, we have there's no dialogue, no possibility of dialogue.
I think you enjoy that subversion that you get from it too.
Oh, I do. Well, Aboriginal life is very much like that. Where there is so much laughter, in our homes, so much laughter where we gather, because I think that's how we are. Most of us are like that.
Tell me about Aboriginal art, because you've said that it's a white invention. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, what I was talking about was the Aboriginal art industry. I wrote an essay in 2002 about this. It's only 4,500 words, so it's a pretty easy read. And I discuss how the market, the Aboriginal art world in the market is the market. So as part of the market, the art market, it's absolutely a white thing.
What is it like for you if you see, in gift shops and places around the Sydney waterfront and that kind of thing, where you can go into a shop and buy a coaster or, a print of some Aboriginal art that I guess many people do. That commodification of it, how do you feel towards that?
I came to contemporary art via tourist art. I was making and painting boomerangs and shields and spears and that sort of thing. So, but I had no idea that this that contemporary art existed. Until it was pointed out to me, by some people. I think a white guy leaned over my shoulder one day and just said, "Why don't you get into fine art?" I said, "What are you talking about? Look at these fine lines here." So, and he said, "No, I mean like high art." I said, "Oh, I'm not interested in that." And then he said to me that, "Well, you can say and do things, in art, and not get arrested." So I said, "Oh, tell me more. Sit down here." And my art education was not in, an art college. It was in my home. I would invite people, to my home, and I would give them food and alcohol and pot and nothing, no heavy drugs, but I did offer them these sorts of things. And all I wanted was information. So I would take them home, and sit down, talk, and pop them for information about art. I think I was a pretty good learner.
Yeah, I'd say. You've talked about how there has to be a day of reckoning around this.
Yes.
Is Australia ready for
Yes.
this?
No. No. Well, last year, proved that it wasn't ready. It's not ready, but nor Aboriginal people. We need to have discussions around what we want. And what we're fighting for. Before we get to that situation, we should be demanding treaties. At the moment, rather than a voice to Parliament, we should be looking at treaties, and having sort of a set number or a set percentage of seats in all houses of government, across all levels of government, in all around the country, this sort of thing. So, we need to be talking about these things at the grassroots level. So our people understand these things, because their lives are fulfilled, with survival. They're worried about, the rent, the food, the clothes, and maybe a pair of Nike shoes or whatever, this sort of thing. So they're distracted by, everyday life.
The voice
We need to
referendum
make
that,
space for them.
yeah, the voice referendum that you're alluding to that failed last year.
Yeah.
What hopes had you had for that, and how big a deal is it that it was knocked back?
Well, yeah, the fact that it was knocked back isn't inconsequential. But I don't think it's as bad as what it's been made out to be. A lot of us, couldn't see the thing getting up anyway. So we're prepared, for a loss, before it even happened. So I think it's a reminder, that we have a lot of work to do. But on the other hand, 60% voted, against it, but 40%, voted for it. And I think that's an encouraging sign. It's easier to grow 40% than it is to grow 60%. So I don't think it'll get worse. I think we have work to do to make sure that number, 40%, rises. And we need to be talking a lot more to each other, face to face, in meetings. To make sure that we communicate these things, as best we can.
And what's the value of festivals like the Maoriland Film Festival that you're at this weekend?
Oh, look, this is revelatory to me. Looking at a community that is working, so closely together to get something like this, up and happening, and to be here, it's very rewarding for me to look at this circumstance, and I've written to the other members of my co collective that I'm part of, proper now, in back in Brisbane, and I'm suggesting that we come here next year, and have a look at the situation and talk with the people from here, between now and then. So I think these sorts of things are absolutely necessary for us to move forward, because this is where a lot of the ideas are coming from. And it's not just coming from within New Zealand, it's coming from, Australia and other parts of the world, all over the world. There are people, presenting their views, their ideas. So I'm thanking them very. Thank you very much for inviting me to this thing. the organisers of Maryland Film Festival.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, Richard, thank you so much for coming on Saturday morning. It's been fantastic to talk to you. A really excellent piece of work, the documentary that Richard has brought to Maryland Film Festival. You can go now. I think it's screening tomorrow, so that would mean that yes, you still have a chance to jump in and see it. Thank you very much, Richard. Lovely to talk to you today.